Indeed, David has captured in his prayer the theme and lesson of the book of Revelation. What verse have we been using as a theme verse for the book? 17:14. These will wage war against the Lamb, and the Lamb will overcome them, because He is Lord of lords and King of kings, and those who are with Him are the called and chosen and faithful. If the Lamb overcomes, what might you call those who are with Him?
Overcomers.
And throughout the book, we've been noting that word from the early chapters, chapter 2 on, about overcoming. And indeed it is a book, as David said in his prayer, that's for the seven churches of Asia, but has application to us today, that we can be assured of the victory that is ours. In our last class, we began looking at chapters 17 through 20. If you have a copy of the lesson, you'll see at the title of the lesson how we title this particular section of the book, Judgment on the Harlot, the Beast, and Satan. These are the three dominant characters in this particular section. You're opened up with chapter 17, verse 1. You'll note the great harlot. And this great harlot, in verse 18 of chapter 17, is identified. It represents what, verse 18? The great city. In chapter 11, verse 8, the great city is identified as what?
Jerusalem.
Okay. So, here the harlot, and this harlot, this city, what is the city name given in this section?
Babylon.
Okay, so it's not talking about geographically the area where Babylon was when it was a world power, but uses that name because it's so rooted in Old Testament history. And here, talking about this city likened unto a harlot. You'll note in verse 1, what does he say about the harlot? What's he going to be talking about?
He will make great
judgment. Judgment. It's a chapter about judgment. Judgment on the harlot. And then when you get down to verse 3, what is she writing?
Riding on the beast.
And so you have the beast. Here's the harlot riding on the beast. We learned from chapter 13 about two beasts. And who are they doing the bidding of? The dragon. Who's the dragon?
Satan.
So you have the harlot, the beast, and Satan. And so we see the harlot's going to be judged, the beast is going to be judged, and then Satan will also be judged. We see that in chapter 20. So that's this section. So the enemies of God's people, the one who had caused their persecution, tried to deceive them, tried to discourage them, kill some of them, they're going to be defeated by the King of Kings and Lord of Lords, and those who are overcomers following Him will enjoy His victory. All right, in our last class, we talked about the harlot and the beast. We did not get to Satan. So let's look at Satan. Chapter 20, verse 2. He laid hold, this angel coming down from heaven, laid hold of the dragon, the serpent of old. Where does he first call that? Genesis 3. So this is the same Satan that we read about in the first few chapters of our Bible. The serpent of old, who is the devil and Satan. All right, so the idea of him being a serpent is associated with what in the early chapters of our Bible? What kind of activity?
Deceiver.
A deceiver. He was a deceiver. And the word devil means what? Okay, Satan's adversary, right? Satan's adversary, and what's devil?
Slanderer.
What?
Slanderer,
blasphemer. And we've seen in earlier chapters, he's trying to accuse God's people before the throne. We saw that back in chapter 12, and he's thrown out. So he's a deceiver, he's an accuser or slanderer, and he not only slanders the Lamb, but he slanders those who follow the Lamb, and he's the adversary of the Lamb and of those who follow him. So here we have this angel lays hold of the dragon, threw him into the abyss, shut it up and sealed it over him so that he would not deceive the nations any longer until the 1,000 years were completed. All right, now we ask you a question on your sheet. We said judgment on Satan is presented in two parts, before and after this 1,000-year period. So here we have before the 1,000 years. And I'm not asking you to interpret meaning, just what does the text say is done with Satan before the 1,000 years?
Thrown into the pit.
Thrown into the pit. And what term here is he used? When he's thrown into there, he's what?
Bound.
He's bound. Okay, now, and it says here, because of this, he couldn't do what? Couldn't deceive the nations any longer. All right. Now back, do you remember in chapter 13, the two beasts? What did they do? Through persecution, through fear, through economic hardship, through false prophets, what did they do? They deceived people, didn't they? If the beast is destroyed, if the harlot is judged, how's Satan going to deceive? This is his means of deception. Judgment has been brought upon the beast and upon the harlot. So he is, quote unquote, bound for a time, 1,000 years. We'll talk about that in just a moment. And so his power to deceive is thoroughly hindered. In chapter 19, verse 20, the beast was seized, and with him the false prophet. We studied two beasts in 13. And one, the second beast, here is called the false prophet. And so, who performed the signs in his presence, by which he deceived those who received the mark of the beast. Now note, by which he deceived, but the beast is destroyed. So Satan is now bound. That is, before this 1,000-year period that's being discussed here in verses 3 and 4. Okay, so that's what you read in the text. Now, it says he couldn't deceive the nations any longer until the 1,000 years were completed. After these things, he must be released for a short time. Go down to verse 7. Now we see what happens to Satan after the 1,000 years. When the 1,000 years are completed, Satan will be released from his prison. And he will come out to deceive. Now, he was bound so he couldn't deceive for 1,000 years. Now he's released so he can deceive again. And so, to deceive the nations which are in the four corners of the earth, Gog and Magog, to gather them together for the war. We had put on your lesson verses from Ezekiel. I don't know if you had an opportunity to read those. But in Ezekiel, the same kind of imagery is used to picture the enemies of God's people waging war on them, this Gog and Magog. And so here you have it again. You have Gog and Magog that Satan gathers for war. What's our theme? 17:14? War. War on the saints. War on the bondservants of God. That's what Satan is doing. He said the number of them is like the sand of the seashore. If you're on the other side, what chance do you have of winning? The armies are innumerable that are against you. And it says they came up on the broad plain of the earth and surrounded the camp of the saints. So here you see they're making war on the saints. Here are the saints encamped. And where are they at? It says in that verse, the beloved city. In the beloved city. Is that the same as the harlot or Babylon? Not hardly, is it? Babylon, when it's pictured there, is not beloved. It's a woman who's pictured as full of immorality, full of sin, full of the blood of the saints. But here, the same city is put in a different light. We'll see more about that when we get to chapter 21 and 22. But this city is comprised of the saints. It's where the saints live. And Satan's making war on them in their beloved city, or in the beloved city. But it says, and fire came down from heaven and devoured them. So here's all these armies, innumerable, but God brought judgment on these armies. Once again, the saints are delivered. And the devil who deceived them was thrown into the lake of fire and brimstone, where the beast and the false prophets are also. So, Satan suffers the same fate that the beast, the two beasts do. They were his servants. We talked about that being persecution and in first part of chapter 13. And then the idea of false religion, human religion, and the fear and the economic hardship and the false signs that it worked back in chapter 13. All of that's destroyed along with Satan. And you see it's a final destruction, and they'll be tormented day and night forever and ever. And so then you have this picture of judgment 11 through 15 on not only Satan, but those who followed Satan versus those who would not follow Satan, those who would not be intimidated by all these efforts that he made and the judgment of reward that's given to them. So let's go back for just a moment now. Back to this 1,000 years in verses 4 through 6. So before the 1,000 years, he's deceiving, but then he's bound for 1,000 years. Then he's released and he's able to go out and deceive again. All of this follows 17 through 19. Judgment on the harlot and the beast and here on Satan. All right, now, in 20, 4 through 6, millennialism. Where's that term come from? Millennialism. Thousand years. Millennial. Pre-millennial. What's the idea?
Before.
Christ is going to come back before the 1,000 years. There's going to be a big war called
Armageddon.
We read about that in 16. And then he's going to reign in Jerusalem for 1,000 years. That's the basic concept. And this is one of the verses that's used. It's a key verse, chapter 16, Armageddon, this verse. We've already talked about Armageddon. It's not a geographical place, but rather a picture of decisive battles. Let's look at this particular text, see what it does say and what it doesn't say. I can remember as a boy talking to my mother about these texts. She was a pretty good Bible student. And she pointed out some things to me back when I was just a boy about this text, and she was right about it. And we have some of that right here on this lesson. Let's look at chapter 20, verse 4 through 6. We have who is said to what. So this text is talking about who. What if I say this text is talking about Christians? Is that correct? Yes? That's kind of a tricky question.
Chapters 24 to 16?
Huh?
Talking about Christ. Talking
about
specific Christians, not all Christians. So your answer, Christian, is not wrong, but it's not Christians generally. Which Christians are these verses talking about? Martyrs. Martyrs. Look, I saw thrones and they sat upon them and judgment was given to them. And I saw the souls of those who had been beheaded or put to death. The idea of beheaded, whether it's that or some other means, the idea of martyrs. Because of their testimony of Jesus and because of the word of God. And why had they suffered that? Here's the answer. And those who had not worshipped the beast or his image. Remember, back in 13, you had this first beast, the second beast, trying to get people to worship the first beast and receive the mark of identity to be associated with them, but these people would not give in. So they suffered You remember back in chapter 13 and verse 10? If anyone is destined for captivity, to captivity he goes. If anyone kills with the sword he must be killed. Here is the perseverance and the faith of the saints. In the face of that, they persevered. And so he said they had not received the mark of the beast on their forehead and on their hand. They had not worshipped the beast. That's the people in view, not Christians generally. So mark that down first. Second question, we ask, what said about them? What is said about them?
They came to life.
They came to life. So what would you call that if people were dead and came to life?
Resurrection.
And you'll note he calls it the first resurrection, down in verse 5. But this is not the resurrection of the body. This is not the resurrection at the end of time. We'll talk about that in just a minute. They were dead, they were martyred, but now they come to life, and what are they doing?
Reigning.
They're sitting on thrones, they're reigning. These saints look like they were defeated, but they're victorious. They're overcomers, and they're reigning. What does it say? Reigning what? With Christ. Okay. And so, does this verse say that Christ reigned 1,000 years? No, it does not. It does not. If I say, Alex and Margaret, they're here this morning, and they're waiting to get their house closed, so they're at our house, and they're living with us. And so if I say, Alex and Margaret lived with us for 4 days or whatever it may be, does that mean I only live 4 days? Does it say anything about how long I live? Doesn't say anything about how long I live, does it? They reigned with Christ. It doesn't say anything about how long Christ reigned. See? Christ is king. He's Lord of lords. And he's giving these people the victory. And they're sharing in his domain, in his rule, in his victory. He's already overcome Satan. The book opened up in chapter 4 and 5, the throne of God and the Lamb at his side being praised. And they reign with him. They share in that. So that's the picture that you have presented. All right. There's some other things that are not mentioned in this verse. Does this verse say anything about the second coming of Christ?
No,
it does not. Sometimes we find ourselves trying to answer arguments that haven't been made. If somebody said, well, here it is, here's the millennium, here's Christ coming back to earth for the second time and reigning on the earth for 1,000 years. Really? Show me that in the verse. Where does it say that? It does not say that. That's assumed based on theology. Does this text say anything about Christ reigning on earth in Jerusalem? Nothing about that. Nothing. And yet this is a key to the premillennial theology. He's going to come back to earth. There's going to be this big war. It's going to be in the valley of Jezreel. And he's going to reign in Jerusalem for 1,000 years. Does this verse say anything about that? Nothing. Nothing. And it doesn't say anything about Christians generally. It talks about martyrs. So let's just stay with the text and what the text says. Hold your finger here and go to John chapter 4 and verse 21. Jesus is speaking to the Samaritan woman. What does he say about where men will worship the Father? Can you paraphrase in your own words? According to verse 21 of John 4.
So,
Where will they worship?
Everywhere.
Everywhere. Anywhere. There is no defined, there's not going to be a defined city. Premillennialists want to make it Jerusalem in the millennium. Jesus said, Jerusalem, not Gerizim, none of that. It's not going to be in a geographical location. That was true under the Mosaic dispensation. They had to go to Jerusalem for their sacrifices, their feast, but not anymore. And so that's one thing. Now look at John 18. What did Jesus say about his kingdom in 1836 and 37? It's not of this world. And he explained further what he meant by that when he in verse 36. If it was of this world, what would happen? How would dominion be given to the king? His armies would fight to give dominion to the king. That's the way worldly kingdoms are established. He said, my kingdom is not of this world. He said, if my kingdom were of this world, then my servants would be fighting. They wouldn't let me be delivered to the Jews. And so he said in 37, Pilate's completely puzzled. Well, I thought you were king. Are you? Yes, I am. Boy, Pilate doesn't understand this at all, because all he understands is worldly kingdoms given by swords and armies. But Jesus explains, he said, for this I've been born, and for this I've come into the world to testify to the truth. Everyone who is of the truth hears my voice. It's people who love the truth, believe the truth, know the truth, adhere to the truth, that are in the dominion or the kingdom, enjoy the rule of the Messiah. And so this idea that his dominion is established by some big battle, that's not the case. His dominion is established in the hearts of men through the truth of the gospel. And so you can see the difference in what is generally said about these passages and what's made of them in the theology that's so popular today. Now it says that they reigned with him 1,000 years. We gave you some verses on your lesson. Let's look at two or three of those. Look at Deuteronomy chapter 7, verse 9. You're back in the first century. You want some entertainment. Where might you go? Beside the chariot races, where might you go? You don't have movies, so what can you do? You go to the theater, watch a play. And in this play, on this stage, to represent ideas, they might have something coming out of the ceiling or something coming out of the floor or various other things, and they'll have sound effects. And so that's what we're watching in the book of Revelation, a sound movie. We call it a movie. But these symbols represent ideas. And so here we have these saints reigning 1,000 years. So many of these symbolic either numbers or things or animals are born out of Old Testament language, pictures. Over in Deuteronomy chapter 7 and verse 9. Know therefore the Lord your God, He is God, the faithful God, who keeps His covenant and His loving kindness to 1,000th generation. Uh-oh. If you're the 1,001st generation, you're out of luck. Is that the idea?
It's complete.
Complete. And to multiply, you know, 10 is the idea of complete. 100, 1,000. It's a way to bring it to the infinite degree. God keeps His covenant of loving kindness. That's what that meant to those people. It wasn't a time statement. It was a concept. And to read into that 1,000 generations, a number, would be to mistake what was being said. Look over at Psalm chapter 50. God owns a lot of cattle. But maybe he doesn't own all of it, because it says, every beast of the forest is mine, the cattle on 1,000 hills. You reckon there's more than 1,000 hills on the earth? We've got to find 1,000 that God's cattle's on. Is that the idea? Or is it all of them are mine? And to a Jewish reader, they'd understand that. Cattle on 1,000 hills. Completeness to the infinite is the idea. Look at 1 Chronicles 16:15. I think this is one of the verses I gave you. First Chronicles chapter 16 and verse 15. Remember his covenant forever, the word which he commanded to 1,000 generations. That's very similar to the Deuteronomy passage. I just put a few of these to illustrate this. It was a common way to represent a concept. Now look over at 2 Peter chapter 3. People have missed this and try to make this passage literal. One day with the Lord, one day is like 1,000 years. So then they go find some kind of passage in the Bible that talks about a certain number of days, and they multiply it by 1,000. It's ridiculous, folks. He's just saying time means nothing to God. That's the idea. If God makes a promise, forget your calendar. He's going to keep it. That's the idea. As we prayed with David, God keeps his promises. Promises of reward, but in this text, also promises of judgment. And so that's the idea of this thousand. And so when we read here in our text, in Revelation 20, they reigned with Christ 1,000 years. These saints who have been persecuted and put to death, they have complete victory. They enjoy fully the reign of the Messiah they died for. That's the idea. Now he talks about this verse 5 being the first resurrection. Look at Isaiah 26. In Isaiah chapter 26 and verse 19, unfortunately we don't have time to go restudy Rocky's Isaiah class, but Rocky tried to point out some of these things as he went through the book of Isaiah. In Isaiah 26:19, your dead will live, their corpses will rise. You who lie in the dust, awake and shout for joy, for your dew is the dew of the dawn, and the earth will give birth to departed spirits. Now, let me tell you how I know that's not the resurrection at the end of time. Look at verse 14. I may not know what this is, but I know what it's not. How do I know from verse 14? What's going to happen in the resurrection on the last day, according to Jesus in John 5:28 and 29? Huh? It says here the wicked will not rise. What did Jesus say in the resurrection at the last day? Everybody's going to be raised, wicked and the righteous. This is not the resurrection of the last day. And yet he uses the idea of resurrection. And so you can go read this, and the idea is they're going to be restored from captivity. Their enemies are pictured as dead. Their dominion is gone. That's the idea. And you'll be raised. Go read it for yourself and you'll see. The death of their oppressor signifies the end of their dominion. Possibly a messianic passage. In Ezekiel 37, verse 12, you're familiar with this passage maybe, the Valley of Dry Bones. Ezekiel was a prophet taken captive in the second captivity, and he was a prophet to the exiles. And it looks like their hopes are dashed. Looks like this is the end. There's still another captivity coming that Ezekiel has prophesied in 586. The city will be destroyed. The temple will be destroyed. The city will be burnt. Is there any hope? It just looks like the field is strewn with the dead carcasses of their nation. But in Ezekiel chapter 37, verse 12, therefore prophesy and say to them, thus says the Lord God, behold, I will open your graves and cause you to come out of your graves, my people, and I will bring you into the land of Israel. Then you will know that I am the Lord when I've opened your graves and caused you to come up out of your graves, my people. I'll put my spirit within you and you'll come to life. I'll place you on your own land. Then you'll know that I, the Lord, have spoken it. While that was partially fulfilled in the physical restoration, look down at verse 24, what the ultimate fulfillment is. My servant David will be king over them. Verse 22, I'll make them one nation. And so, this is again a picture of defeated people now enjoying victory. They're dead, but they're going to come to life. That picture is presented under the concept of a resurrection. Look at Romans chapter 11. In Romans chapter 11, verse 15, chapters 9 through 11, Paul, in the first eight chapters, he presents the idea that men are saved by the grace of God through faith. It's not a matter of your lineage, not a matter of your race. It's through faith in the gospel of the crucified Messiah, as we present in those first eight chapters. Then the question arose among the Jews, well, what about us? Aren't we God's people? And why has God preserved us all this time? We're still a people at the time the Roman letter was written. And so in 9 through 11, he deals with God's dealings with the Jewish nation. And so in chapter 11, in verse 15, he said, if their rejection is the reconciliation of the world, in other words, because the Jewish nation was rejected as a nation, it opened the gospel to everybody, what will their acceptance be? So if these Jews who rejected physically, lineage, but now if they come to faith and they are God's people through faith, what will it be, he said? Well, how does he describe it there? Life from the dead. What is that? What's one word that describes that? Resurrection or salvation, right. And so you see that the conversion of the Jews to the gospel is pictured under the idea of resurrection. So don't, when you read the term in Revelation 25, resurrection, it's like that word coming. We've been reading all through the book of Revelation. When people say coming, they think what?
Second
coming. But that's not necessarily the case. Sometimes the word refers to that, but we can't arbitrarily put that meaning on that word. Same with the word resurrection. Anytime you find that, look at the context and see what the idea is. And here, in fact, there's nothing said about their bodies being raised here. It's the idea of victory, life. They've been defeated, but now they reign with Christ. That's the picture that's being presented. Another indication this is not the resurrection at the end of time, how many people are raised? Or who are raised?
The martyrs.
The martyrs. Not everybody, not all Christians. The martyrs are raised. The resurrection at the time, or just the martyrs going to be raised?
No.
Secondly, what's going to happen after the 1,000 years?
Satan's
going to be released. Satan going to be released after the end of time on the earth?
No.
Earth will be destroyed. And then you have something we've just started noticing from the first chapter on, something about time constraints. What's this book generally, at least, having to do with? Things that are quickly, soon to come to pass, near. And so we saw that from chapter 1 all the way to the end of the book. We've been looking at that over and over and over again. So yeah, you can take Revelation 20, ignore the context, jump in the middle of it, make a theology out of it. You can do that with anything in the Bible. I can take Acts 16:31 and prove you don't have to be baptized to be saved. Because it says whoever believes in the name of the Lord will be believe in the Lord Jesus Christ and you'll be saved. That's what it says. And ignore the context. So, same thing here. And so do not be alarmed by these kind of things. All right. Now, you have a choice to make. We ran across that back in chapter 14, those three choices. You have a choice to make. You can follow the Lamb, but that may mean persecution. That may mean captivity. It may mean death. Or you can follow the beast or the harlot or Satan. But you will suffer the consequences of your choice. And so in chapter 20, verse 11, through the end of the chapter, here you have the great white throne, him who sat on it, his presence, before his presence, earth and heaven fled away. No place was found for them. I saw the dead, the great and the small, standing before the throne, and books were opened. Another book was opened, which is the book of life, and the dead were judged from the things which were written in the book according to their deeds. So you made a choice what kind of life you're going to live. The sea gave up the dead which were in it. Death, Hades gave up the dead which were in them. And they were judged, every one of them, according to their deeds. And death and Hades were thrown into the lake of fire. This is the second death. In other words, there's no rising from this one. This is it. This is the end. Not talking about unconsciousness. Talking about judgment. And so, if anyone's name is not written in the book of life, he is thrown into the lake of fire. You follow Satan, you suffer the consequences Satan did. You see in verse 10, the devil is thrown into the lake of fire. The beast is thrown into the lake of fire. The false prophet is thrown into the lake of fire. You follow them, you suffer the same consequences. When Jesus painted the judgment day scene in Matthew 25, and he talked to those people who did not serve, they were driven away into eternal torment. And what did he say it was prepared for? The devil and his angels. Prepared for the devil and his angels. God doesn't want people to go there. But if that's your choice, then you suffer those consequences. And so it's really a great lesson of assurance and victory here in chapter 17 through 20. Okay. You have your 21 through 22 lesson. 21 through 22, 5. All we're going to have time, we've got 5 minutes to kind of introduce it. Let me introduce the concept. If you've done the sheet, you're way ahead of me. If you haven't already read those verses I have at the beginning of the lesson, Isaiah 11, 30, chapter 30, chapter 49, 51, 60, 66, just a few verses in each one, 2 Peter 3:13. Take time to read those. You're going to see this kind of imagery that we're going to be reading about in those passages. And you'll read some of the statements in, like in Isaiah 11, 6 through 10. You'll immediately pick up on the fact that that's not literal. And when you read Isaiah 11 or Isaiah 49, if you look over at your marginal references, for example, like particularly in 49, you'll have references in the New Testament where those verses are referred to and clearly made to refer to the Messiah. In other words, they're given spiritual meaning. So you can go look at that yourself, but that will be helpful in preparing for 21 and 22. That's one thing that I want to stress. Contrast. Now, you note we have throughout the book up to this point, particularly from 13 on and then in chapter 15 and 16, the seven angels with the seven bowls of wrath. And then you have this picture in 17, 18, and 19, and 20. Contrast the imagery of judgment in the previous chapters of Revelation with the imagery of blessing in 21 and 22. You have that contrast. If you've been in the Revelation class, you know that what we're talking about is so. But if you haven't been, go back and compare that. We saw this movie divided into two parts. So it picks up again in chapter 12 with Satan going to wage war against the saints at the end of chapter 12. But there's judgment on those who oppress the saints. And so now we're going to get to a section of blessing. All right? Here's a contrast. In chapter 17, we're introduced to this harlot. And in chapter 17, 18, we're told this harlot is likened unto what? A city, the great city. And it's called what?
Babylon.
So here you have this woman. And what kind of woman is she? How does he describe her? A harlot. Cup full of immorality. Sensuality. Full of sin. Unclean. Ungodly. And she's likened unto the city, Babylon, with all of its iniquity. And the wine in her cup, when we studied that, what is that? The blood of the saints. So there's that woman. That's what we've been reading about, chapter 17 on. Now, when you get to chapter 21 and 22, we're going to see a different picture. Back in these previous chapters, like chapter 14, verse 7, fear God and give Him glory because the hour of His judgment has come. Chapter 15, verse 4, these saints are singing the song of Moses and praising God for all your righteous acts have been revealed. Talking about His acts of judgment. In chapter 16, verse 7, praising God for His righteous judgments. And we saw that all the way through chapter 18, verse 10, for example. For in 1 hour your judgment has come. And then we just looked at chapter 19. And the judgment there in verse 20, being thrown into the alive into the lake of fire, and also in chapter 20, 11 through 15. Now we get to this section 21 through 22, where it totally changes. Okay, my time's just about up. If you haven't done it already, we've only got one class left. Do this. Read those verses I gave you on the sheet. Compare what is said in those verses. It's called the New Jerusalem. Go back and read those verses and see some of the things in the book. Not in theology, not in a commentary. In the book that said to these saints something about new, something different for these saints. And now we're going to read about this New Jerusalem and them enjoying this very thing. And so we have two sections here. Contrast this city, the old city Babylon, with the New Jerusalem. So the old city, if it's Jerusalem, some think it's Rome. We're not making an issue out of that. But if it's the old physical Jerusalem, it makes such a clear contrast with Judaism and its concepts and its persecution of Christians with the New Jerusalem where the Christians are pure and reign. They're the bride of the Lamb. And then in contrast to their state as they suffered under Babylon, you'll see all the beauty of the New Jerusalem with the new things that are characteristic of it. So we're going to have to work through that pretty rapidly, and then we'll finish up with the epilogue at the end of the book. Okay? Thank you very much.